Celebration Rock Podcast presented by 93XFM here in Minneapolis and uprocks.com. I'm your host, Stephen Hayden. Today we have another installment of Contrarian's Canon, where I talk about records that for some reason don't have a very good reputation among critics and fans, but I happen to like them, and my co-host in this series, Riley Walker, really likes them too. So we've already talked about Jesus Freak by DZ Talk. And we talked about The Division Bell by Pink Floyd. You can go back into our archives and find those episodes. Today we're doing something a little bit different because it's a record that I personally am not a fan of, but Riley loves, and he loves it so much that he recently covered it for an album that's coming out on November 16th. The album is The Lilywhite Sessions. It's by Dave Matthews Band. It's a record that actually was never officially released. It was sort of a lost record for Dave Matthews. They worked on it in the late 90s. And it was this collection of dark, sort of booze-soaked songs that the band and I guess the label decided not to put out. And then Dave Matthews went out and he wrote a bunch of songs with Glenn Ballard, a very well-known pop producer. He was the guy who worked with Alanis Morissette on Jagged Little Pill. They produced this record called Every Day for Dave Matthews Band in 2001. That was a big hit. But the fans were like, hey, Lilywhite Sessions, this is where the real shit is, the gritty Dave Matthews. This is what we want. So it has this great reputation among fans, and Riley Walker has been a fan since he was a kid, and he made this covers record, which is sort of like an indie rock reimagining of this Dave Matthews record. And we had a really interesting talk because, you know, Riley was raised on Dave Matthews, and I was raised disliking Dave Matthews. I went to college in the late 90s. If you were in college from, like, you know, 96 to 2000, the way I was, Dave Matthews Band was, like, inescapable. They were a fixture of bro culture on every college campus. And, you know, because of that association, it just turned me off. And over the years, I've tried to get into them, you know, to sort of question my own assumptions about this band and maybe kind of come around, because I like liking stuff. I like liking bands. I like kind of taking an artist that I had dismissed previously and finding a new way to look at them so I can at least, if not love that artist, have some sort of appreciation for what they're doing. And I've been able to do that with a lot of people. Like, I can talk myself into liking a lot of stuff, but Dave Matthews Band has always been a bridge too far for me. So I thought this would be a great opportunity for Riley to make his case for Dave Matthews Band, to talk about this record, The Lilywhite Sessions. And, you know, maybe I'll change my mind. You know, we'll see. But before we get to that, I want to tell you about our sponsor for this week's episode, and it is Harry's. And, you know, if you're someone like me, I've got a beard, and I'm always growing hair out of my face. I got to keep it high and tight, as they say. So I need a good stock of razors in my house to make sure that I look presentable when I leave and go out into the world. And I find that Harry's is one of the best deals that you can get, because not only are the razors affordable, they come right to your house. So you don't have to go to the drugstore and have to go through that whole rigmarole. I have a special offer for my listeners, because I think you're going to like this. Now, Harry stands behind the quality of their blades, but they know that switching razors isn't an easy decision, so they created a trial offer, and you can claim yours by going to harrys.com/rock. Now, what are you going to get in this offer? Well, in this value trial set, you're going to get your weighted ergonomic handle, you're going to get a 5-blade razor with lubricating strip and trimmer blade, the rich lathering shave gel, and the official travel blade cover, a favorite here at Celebration Rock. Would you say so, Derek?
I love it. You know, it's funny because I went to Austin a few weeks ago and I forgot my travel blade cover, and I had to actually go out to the drugstore and get razors. And that whole process with, like, the everything's been a locked case, you know, and it's the worst.
When you shave your head.
Right. Yeah. So there's, like, some necessary shaving that needs to occur for me because I got a lot of area to cover.
So whether you're shaving your face or your head or wherever else, and I don't want to know where, you want to go to harrys.com/rock. get your trial set. And not only are you going to get some great razors, you're going to support the podcast. So again, go to harrys.com/rock. harrys.com/rock. Okay, so again, this is Contrarians Canon. We talk about records that have been dismissed or overlooked in music history, and we dig them out and we say, hey, give this record another listen. And not only am I one of the hosts of this show, I'm also a client because this week's album is an album that I don't really like, but I want to, you know, maybe see what's cool about it. So Riley Walker, he educated me about Dave Matthews Band, and you know, we'll see what I say. So let's get into it. Here's me and Riley Walker talking about the Lily White Sessions on the Celebration Rock Podcast. So are you in Brooklyn now?
No, I'm currently back in Chicago because I got to grab some gear to move or to fly to Europe tomorrow. But yes, I'm now a resident of Brooklyn. I paid the astonishing amount of rent that it requires to live there for a month. I'm in Brooklyn. I live there.
Now, I have to give you a little shit for this because, you know, I'm in the Midwest and you're moving from the Midwest. I mean, like, why did you decide to become an indie rock cliche?
Well, you know, like all great tropes and cliches in the indie rock canon, I got to move on to bigger and better things. I got to have more late night food. I got to have more tantalizing anxiety and fear in my life. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. So you're just like big timing Chicago. Is that it?
I'm one upping you guys, baby. You all enjoy everything back there in the middle of the country, but I'm out in New York eating bagels and trying to get on guest list to gigs I don't belong at. That's me now. I wear leather jackets and everything.
And I mean, you haven't been out there long. I mean, have you been enjoying it?
I really do. And, you know, Chicago's and the Midwest has always been great to me. And I really thought I would be a lifer. I thought I'd always live and die in Chicago and Illinois. But I don't know, a switch kind of flipped, and I'm very happy out there. I have a lot more things I want to get working on out there. And but, you know, Chicago's always a $60 round trip Southwest flight away, and I intend on coming back a lot and eating lots of deep fried foods. That part of me can never go away.
You know, I drove through your hometown the other day of Rockford, Illinois, and I mean, I was just on the highway, so I didn't actually go into the town, but isn't there something called like Safari Town or something? Am I getting that wrong? It's like on the side of the highway. It's like a kid's playland or something.
Oh, there's a go-kart track called Volcano Falls.
That's it. Okay.
And, yeah, I remember when it first opened, they had a, you know, like a fake volcano thing. I mean, obviously a fake volcano. The middle of Illinois isn't exactly known for its active volcanoes and lava and magma or whatever the shit goes on in those things. But they had a bunch of smoke, you know, barreling out of it. So everybody was calling it fires, all these concerned, you know, sort of stay-at-home moms and dads were worried that the entire city was burning down. So they had to turn the coolest part of the go-kart track off, which was the smoke.
Oh, man. Well, I just want to ask you Rockford questions for the rest of this podcast, but I'm guessing this isn't, like, overly scintillating listening for people. So maybe we should get talking about Dave Matthews Band, the Lily White Sessions, here on another Contrarians Canon episode. I'm very excited about this, that we're doing this third part in the series, and this is going to be like a different episode because we've previously talked about DC Talk by we talked about Jesus Freak by DZ Talk, and we talked about The Division Bell by Pink Floyd, two indisputable classics, masterpieces, peaks of modern music, both of those albums. And now we're talking about Dave Matthews Band, and this is different because, one, you recorded a cover of this record that's coming out, what is that, November 16th?
That's correct.
November 16th. So, and we're going to talk about that later. The other difference is that you love this record, and I do not love this record, and I do not love any Dave Matthews Band records. And I'm kind of hoping in this episode that you can talk me into liking them, because I want to like them. I feel like I should like them, because I generally can talk myself into liking any stadium rock band, I feel like, at some point. But I've never been able to get into Dave Matthews Band. So before we get into the record and the band's career, I guess I'm just like as an overview question for all of us out there who don't get this band, what is it about Dave Matthews that we're missing?
That's a very good question to ask. And Dave Matthews is historically pretty divisive, you know, because I think everybody sort of, you know, under the age of, you know, maybe 45 at this point, that was sort of part of the larger American pop culture zeitgeist. He was just ever-present. He was omnipresent throughout pop culture in the 90s. And, you know, still to this day, but 90s and early 2000s was definitely Dave Matthews' wheelhouse, where it was just, you know, every movie had a song on there, and every sort of live event of the summer had Dave Matthews' band headlining. And I think Dave Matthews just got so big that a lot of people might not enjoy it or might not have looked deeper into it, as with anything else that goes on in sort of big stadium rock bands, you know. But for me personally, it's just like a band like Fish or the Dead. Obviously, some Fish heads and Dead heads out there probably don't like Dave Matthews. Some people in those sort of camps really do. But, you know, it's a whole kind of cultural thing, I think. It's fun music. I think Dave Matthews is a great songwriter. I really do. I think he's a great writer. I think the science and the tightness and the sort of athleticism that this band has is kind of goes beyond a lot of different jam bands. Like, they're just so incredibly tight. Their chemistry is kind of undeniably brilliant, you know. And I think even for somebody who kind of sits outside of being a fan of Dave Matthews, you can kind of just see like the amazing just workmanship they put into this music. Like, they're an incredibly tight band, you know, stop on a dime sort of thing. But, you know, at the same time, it's not like prog with a capital P, or, you know, some sort of corny, ponytailed technical death metal thing that's sort of unapproachable by the casual music fan. It's kind of music for everybody. I think it's like really fun. It's dancey, and again, I think Dave Matthews is a great songwriter, and the live show is what kind of gets me every time. I like the studio records a lot, but their live recordings are honestly amazing, and, you know, they're just like any other jam band. You can go back 25 years plus and find just, you know, a show for you or an era for you. And they reached such a level of popularity, I get why they would be divisive. You know, there was one of the biggest bands of the 90s and of all time. You know, one of the biggest selling artists ever. So obviously people are, you know, record heads or record nerds or serious music people would be kind of skeptical approaching Dave Matthews, you know, at this day and age. And I see it. But, you know, there's a lot of things coming around right now.
Yeah.
It's Dead and you name it. So it's all pretty exciting. I don't know. I love Dave Matthews. I think it's just a fun, exhilarating band.
Now, like, I want to get back to what you were saying about the ubiquity of Dave Matthews' band, because I think you're onto something there, where, especially early in the band's career, like from the mid to late 90s and into the early 2000s, they really were inescapable if you were going to college at that time. Like, I was in college from 96 to 2000. I don't know when their second album, Crash, came out exactly, but I distinctly remember my freshman year walking from the upper part of campus, where I went to the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire, so there's like a hill where a bunch of the dorms are, and then you go down the hill to where a lot of the school buildings are. I walked from one end of the campus to the other, and I literally heard that fucking album coming out of like a window continuously that entire walk. Like, it was weird. It was like Dave Matthews' band was like stalking me throughout the campus. And it was something that I think, you know, I associated it with sort of like the bro-y part of college culture. You know, it seemed like every dude in cargo shorts, you know, loved Dave and would see Dave at Alpine Valley and talk about it. And it was just like, fuck that. Like, I want nothing to do with that. And, you know, now that I'm older and more enlightened and not as prone to judging bands based on who listens to them, because I think that's a problematic way, obviously, of judging music. You know, like, I've come around on jam bands. You know, you mentioned Fish and the Grateful Dead, and those were groups that I didn't like when I was in college, and I came around to when I was older. For me, the entry point for both of those bands were the guitar players. You know, Jerry Garcia and Trey Anastasio were, you know, these great guitar players. They're playing awesome solos, and it was something that I could connect with that. And it helped me kind of get into maybe some of the more sort of jammy or more difficult aspects of what they're doing. And with Dave Matthews' band, I was thinking about this. as I was getting ready for the podcast, and I was listening to the Lily White sessions, and I was listening to like the Red Rocks record from 95 and some other things. Like, what is the lead instrument in this band? Is it, because it's not Dave Matthews, unless you count his vocals, I guess. I mean, is it the drums? Is it like the goddamn violin or the saxophone? Like, or am I just kind of thinking of it wrong and sort of contextualizing it that way?
No, I don't think you're thinking about it wrong at all. Because, I mean, obviously with such a band like Fish, the sum of its parts is what makes Fish great. Obviously, you know, you need, you know, Mike on bass. You know, you need the whole band together to kind of make it work. But, you know, Trey's solos just kind of carry everything together, and you're kind of just like the shimmery thing on top that makes it work so well. Whereas you're kind of, that's a really good point. What is the lead instrument of Dave Matthews? They're a really big band. You know, they're bigger than a lot of, especially now, you know, they have like a whole horn section stuff. But at its core, you know, the classic lineup was, you know, Carter Beaufort on drums, Dave on vocals and guitar, Roy Moore on reeds and sax, Boyd Tinsley on violin, and Stefan Lessard on bass. You know, so it's kind of, and they're kind of an odd instrumentation, you know. A jam band to me is, you know, the classic dead with guitars, bass, and keys. And drums, you know, so add violin and horns on it. It's all, you know, horn and violin and guitar all sort of have the same range. So there's sort of three high range instruments sort of battling for that sort of spot. Whereas the low end is Carter Beaufort, who's just, you know, a fucking monster on drums. It's just, it's like the guy's like a decathlon runner on drums. You know, it's just, there's no sort of mistake with him. Everything is so tight. And Stefan Lessard is a great bassist. He's really solid. They work together really well. So you have just these opposite ends of the spectrum, both going insane. You know, it's not like a solid rhythm section like Zeppelin or Sabbath or something, where it's just like, we're the fucking low end, like carrying the shit. Like, they're going all over. It's like a thousand things are going on at once. So as far as the lead instrument, that's a really good question. I don't know. But they all do their roles extremely well.
Yeah.
I think, and Dave Matthews by no means is like a lead guitarist. I think, you know, it's funny, kind of sidetrack here. When I was younger, Dave Matthews was pitched to me, the whole band, like, you know, because I'm kind of a second-generation fan, I guess. I'm a little younger than the OG heads of, like, 94 Red Rocks area or late 90s college Dave Matthews fans era. So I'm a second-generation fan, and the band was pitched to me as just everybody in this band is a absolute prodigy at what they do. They are the best in the world. And obviously, you know, I think they're all incredibly talented and very special, but I don't think best in the world. I think they'd even agree. But everybody was pitched, you know, Carter Beaufort is the best drummer on the planet. Dave Matthews is the best guitarist, you know, et cetera, ad nauseum. And I think, you know, Dave Matthews is an amazing guitarist. What he does, I think people won't give him credit for it, but he's really revolutionary at the sort of guitar he plays, where he has these really extended, weird chords. The guy has, he's not going to play like a Jimmy Page or, you know, Trey or Jerry type solo. He's not going to, like, rip all over. He's not that kind of guitarist. But, you know, he has this sort of flexibility and strange chords and just kind of ripping all over. And also just being a front man. He's just, you know, I got to say, as much as I love Trey and Jerry, I don't want to knock them down at all, but, you know, they're kind of, they're not really front men in the sense like Dave Matthews is. And I don't mean that in like marketability or something. I mean, Dave Matthews like guides that band completely. You know, he's like, he does like all these amazing cues, whereas, you know, Fish and the Dead all sort of kind of fall into it.
Well, and he's like doing those faces, like.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the guy's like.
He's doing like he's scrunching up his face and like, you know, really kind of drawing out his vocals. And like that kind of thing.
Yeah, and the guy's got a great voice, you know. And
oh man, that's where we diverge, my friend. I hate it.
I think he's got an amazing voice.
I hate his voice.
Definitely,
man.
Where the two camps divide right there is people either hate Dave Matthews' voice or they hate the sort of jock culture around him. And I'm here to tell you, the jock culture around him is pretty nice people, you know. So I used to make blanket statements too about all sorts of, but you know, the jock culture is just, you know, that's one camp of it. But when you go to a Dave show, you know, everybody's friends, everybody's hanging out.
Right.
Sure, a few more flip-flops than usual, but, you know, it's a good crowd.
Yeah, well, exactly. That's how these things always work. You make, you know, your blanket judgments, and then you actually go meet people, and it's like, oh, it's a good people. Like, why was I such an asshole before? And that's what I want to do with Dave Matthews Band. And I feel like I've done that with a lot of bands from that era that I didn't like originally, and then I kind of come around to at least having a grudging respect at some point. And that hasn't happened yet with Dave Matthews. I'm hoping it changes at some point. Maybe this podcast will be the transition.
And just to add on to that point, and it goes back to it, the reason Dave gets shit on it is by, you know, record nerds or heads, is because how big he was. Again, he was just so part of society. Like, really, right. He was part of American pop culture. He was up there with, like, you know, Bono or any one of those giant rock star bands. He was everywhere. But the thing I really love about Dave Matthews, and I don't know him as a person, and, you know, real pal around or anything, but the thing I love about Dave Matthews as a person is that his sort of rock stardom seems really approachable and nice, you know? And whereas, you know, somebody like Bono or, I don't know, let's say Sting or whatever, or even Kurt Cobain to a certain extent, who's just this damaged sort of outsider, Dave Matthews seems like a guy who's just, like, kind of down to hang and drink a beer. Like, they all seem like really approachable, nice people. You know, there's, and I guess, you know, every band has their problems and sort of melodrama and sort of shit they're, you know, painted in the corner with, like, you know, they're cross to bear as a band or whatever. But they all seem like they're genuinely having a good time. They're very approachable people with not a ton of drama, you know. So I really like that about Dave Matthews' Band as far as their, you know, image and pop culture is concerned.
Well, let's walk through their career a little bit and set the table for the Lily White sessions here. Give people, I guess, the context of what led up to that moment in the band's career. You know, they form in 1991 in Charlottesville, Virginia, and you mentioned all the band members earlier. You know, you got Dave Matthews on guitar, you have bassist Stefan Lessard, you have the drummer Carter, is it Beauford or Buford? You said Beauford,
Carter,
right?
Beauford.
And by the way, yeah, you've sung his praises. That's like the one thing I feel like everyone concedes about Dave Matthews Band. You know, even people who are like, oh, they suck, but the drummer is good. So, like, people know that they have a good drummer. That's always, like, the thing I feel like about them. You have saxophonist Leroy Moore, who sadly passed away in 2008 in an ATV accident, or he got injured and he passed away after that. Then you have Boyd Tinsley on violin, and he was fired this year. Apparently someone accused him of, like, sexual assault or something.
He ran into some, caused some trouble, I guess.
So that's for another podcast. They put out their first album on a major label in 1994, Under the Table and Dreaming. I remember my stepbrother gave me this album I think it was for Christmas that year. So it was already a big enough album where, like, step siblings were giving it to other step siblings during holidays. It's like, oh, this kid's into music. I'll get him a Dave Matthews Band CD. And I remember I sold it pretty soon after that and probably bought Vitalogy or something.
Damn.
So Under the Table and Dreaming, I mean, there's a lot of hits on that record. What Would You Say, Ants Marching, Satellite, big Dave Matthews Band songs. Like, how do you feel about the first record?
Under the Table and Dreaming, I'm a massive fan of. I really enjoy all their early studio work. I mean, again, they were really young. They were just a college bar band, you know? And especially going on at the time, I guess a lot of alt rock was big and stuff. But when you think about sort of the Dave Matthews scene, who else you got? You got, like, Blues Traveler, or what are those other kind of bands who could be compared to Dave at the time? I don't know. It was just this funky sort of college. You know, the Dead was kind of starting to suck a lot live. I mean,
yeah, Blues Traveler was huge. That was like Run Around and that whole thing. So, yeah, like, 94,
yeah, and
95.
I guess for these bands who were, like, sort of raised on, like, 80s Dead and stuff like that, like Dave Matthews' Blues Traveler, and they sort of came out with these sort of funky college town things, you know, whereas I think the focus at that time, you know, was all, like, L.A., you know, do drugs, or New York be grimy, or maybe Seattle, whatever, you know, grunge stuff. You know, all these, like, little towns like Madison, and Charlottesville, Virginia sort of had, like, these bands who they saw as some sort of viable pop commodity, you know. And I love their early work. You know, it's kind of a sign of the times. Like, that can never happen again now. Yeah. So I love that early record, absolutely.
So, and then you have Crash after that, comes out in 96, and it came out April 30th, 1996. So that was, like, right before I graduated high school. And I think that was the album I heard when I went to college. Like,
Yeah, that must have just been omnipresent in your life.
Seven times platinum. Crash Into Me is on that record. So Much to Say. I know that was a hit. I don't know. I'm looking at the track list. Proudest Monkey. I know that fucking song, sadly. Proud. Do you like Proudest Monkey?
Who doesn't like Proudest Monkey?
I don't know, man. I'm not with that song. You know, Crash Into Me again. I can get behind that song, I guess. I mean, when it was in Lady Bird, I liked that. You know, I liked how it was used in that movie, and it kind of made me appreciate that song more. I mean,
that song is so gorgeous. I mean, I think that everything that's been said about it can be said.
And I think, you know, when we were comparing them to other jam bands, you know, that is really a big departure point with Dave Matthews Band too. Like, Fish is not going to write a song like Crash Into Me, you know, like just this, you know, pretty ballad that.
I mean
that as a compliment, like, you know, that's a song that like anyone could get into. You don't have to like be into jam bands to like Crash Into Me. You know, that's like a
no, not at all.
Kind of
that's
across the
kind
board
of
song.
Separates Dave. I mean, because Fish, as great as they are, and I'm a big Fish head and the Deadhead, you know, those bands are kind of, I'm not saying this to take down Dave or say he's not as brilliant as I think, you know, he is. I think Dave is really brilliant. But, you know, they can write pop hits for the radio, and, like, you know, Fish and the Dead are kind of like just ugly dudes, you know, just
right.
Kind of dumpy. And, you know, and they were super into drugs and stuff, whereas, you know,
and they appeal to ugly dudes,
like you. Party band, like, to have a good time.
And they appeal to ugly dudes like you and me. I mean, like, you can go to a Fish or Grateful Dead show, it's a bunch of ugly dudes in the audience.
Oh, you're a beautiful man.
Oh, well, thank you. And yeah, I think you're actually very gorgeous as well. But I'm just saying, you know, ugly in sort of the theoretical sense or the figurative sense. Just a bunch of smelly, you know, lumbering guys usually in the make up a big
like
part of those audiences.
Smoker Roach kind of bands. Where, I mean. And I remember hearing Dave Matthews Crash on the radio constantly, you know, and that was kind of a cool, because Fish was set up and presented as, like, you know, their studio records are okay with their live show. They just fucking split shit in half, you know, they do 30-minute versions of Lawn Boy or whatever, you know. But, you know, Dave Matthews, like, had these radio hits, and I don't think people knew, at least, you know, people like, you know, my cousins or sort of, I don't want to call people, well, I call them normal music listening people who go about their daily lives and listen to the radio, who have, you know, no interest or care. You know, they can put on a Dave Matthews song, go, I really like this, and still be, you know, unaware of, like, their live shows are legendary, and they do, like, 3.5-hour sets and stuff like that.
Well, and that leads into the next record, which isn't a studio record, but I feel like it's pretty important for Dave Matthews, certainly draws a live band, which is the Live at Red Rocks record, which came out in 97. It's a record.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it's from the 95 show. I was just looking at the track listing, and getting back to Proudest Monkey, the live version is 2 minutes shorter than the studio version, which I think is interesting. It's like Dave was like, I got to get out of Proudest Monkey. We played Proudest Monkey too long on the record. Let's get the fuck out of this song. Like, seriously, Proudest Monkey?
Maybe he was taking your advice. And your criticism of not enjoying the song too much, you heard.
I'm really just kind of making. I really just hate the title, I think, more than anything. But he's talking about,
know,
like, how people are like monkeys, right? Like, he's saying, like, oh, like, we think we're so much better than animals. So, like, we're the proudest monkey.
Guess.
Is that the gist of the lyrics of that song?
I'd say so, you know. And Dave Matthews, as much as people might goof on him, I think the guy's pretty introspective and a good writer. I think a lot of his best songs are kind of just about, you know, he really is self-deprecating in his music. If you listen a lot to it, there's a lot of self-deprecating shit and a lot of pain and emotion. The guy knows a bad time and a good time, I'll tell you that.
I mean, do you prefer the live stuff to the studio records?
Well, it's kind of a toss-up. I mean, I like them both so much. And honestly, like any like hardcore Dave Matthews fan who's going to listen to this podcast will probably disagree with me. Because ever since I've announced this record, like, I've kind of been keeping tabs on what like real Dave Matthews fans are saying. My favorite Dave Matthews stuff, let's not go too far ahead, but I like, you know, some of their later records a lot, some of my favorite. But the live stuff is incredible, yeah. I mean, Live at Red Rocks is definitely a really good introduction to like what they could do as a band and, you know, how energetic they are. And, I mean, they're just like a Fish audience and a Dead audience is just like super fucking stoned. In the amphitheater at Alpine Valley or Tinley Park, whatever. And not that Dave Matthews fans aren't, you know, but I think the crowd participation in their shows is incredible. Just like the huge, just sort of like anthemic, like it's stadium rock music for jam band fans, kind of contained within this sort of spiritual fun element that I really enjoy. The kind of, I don't want to say transcends Fish of the Dead, but kind of like helps them go toe to toe and have a different approach to it. Just the, I mean, again, like the word, like the athleticism of this band is just incredible. It's like they're just, you know, whereas Fish and the Dead were chain smoking and shooting heroin in their eyeballs, these guys are just like in the gym fucking working it, and they're just so tight live. And Red Rocks is a great example. I think, you know, 95 is when they first became one of the biggest bands in the world. So this is like sort of a great document. It's like their great fucking rise, and they're at the top of the goddamn world, you know, like look at where we've made it. And beyond that, they're just perfecting it, you know.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when you were talking about how like athletic they are, it just made me think of how, like, if Jimmy Buffett had trickier time signatures, I think it would he'd be Dave Matthews Band. I mean, I feel.
Damn, you're gonna do Dave like that?
I'm sorry. It just came. I thought I maybe that's going too far, but you know, I'm not there yet. I'm not convinced. But you are making a very good case. I just want to say, like, this is a very good case.
I think
you're making me want to listen to these records that you're describing. Like, I've listened to the actual records and I couldn't get into them, but like the way you're describing it makes me like want to go back and be like, okay, I obviously missed something. So you're making a good case.
And as far as the studio records go, I really enjoy them. I think the songs are great. My only thing that I'm sort of against, which you have to look beyond, I guess, is that, you know, Dave Matthews Band, they were getting, I don't know, I have to assume tens of millions of dollars to make records. And they sound like they cost tens of millions of dollars to make.
Yeah.
Just very high production value that might sometimes take me out of the sort of energy on the record that I know they're exuding in the studio, you know,
Well, the fact that you mentioned the production here, that's a good segue to talk about the producer of these records, because it's Steve Lillywhite, which is referenced in the title, The Lillywhite Sessions. Steve Lillywhite produced the albums we've already talked about, Under the Table and Dreaming and Crash, and also their third record, Before These Crowded Streets, which came out in 98, also debuted at number one, sold 421,000 records in its first week. It actually knocked the Titanic soundtrack from number one. Like, Titanic was number one for like 4 months.
Yeah, fuck Titanic.
And then Dave Matthews comes along and is like, this is Dave territory. Take a seat, Celine Dion. And then they go to number one. So again, speaking to how huge this band was in the 90s, like they were as big as any pop star, like at their peak. And really, like I was reading that, I think they're the only group to have like 7 albums debut at number one. And like that includes their most recent record that came out in 2018, whose name is escaping me at the moment. You remember the name of that record that came out this year? Come Tomorrow.
Nobody remembers it.
So anyway, so Steve Lillywhite, again, he's a very famous rock producer. He worked with U2. He's like one of the producers of the Joshua Tree. He produced the third Peter Gabriel record, the one like with the melting face, which is a great record. He did like the first Psychedelic Furs record. He did like a Rush record. He did the only album by The Laws, which is a favorite of mine. He did Billy Breed's.
Oh my God, one of my all-time favorites. That's another podcast. I would love to talk about The Laws.
Oh yeah, The Laws. Absolutely.
God damn it.
And I going back off. To Fish, he did Billy Breed's, which I think is their best studio record. So Lillywhite is a big-time producer. He was a big fan of Dave Matthews Band. Like you said, record company giving them millions of dollars. They're working with Lillywhite, who I think, if there's a common link on his records, you know, they sound really roomy, they sound live, they sound really big. He's typically working with like sort of big time arena rock or stadium rock people, and he's good at, I think, translating a live band's energy in a studio setting. And certainly I think you would say, as glossy as those early, you know, those early records are, compared to like what came after this, after Lillywhite stopped working with them for a bit or was asked to stop working with them, they got really slick after this on their 2001 record, Every Day, where Dave Matthews was like writing songs with Glenn Ballard. And Glenn Ballard, you know, from
playing baritone guitar.
Glenn Ballard, of course, he's like one of the writers of Jagged Little Pill, the Alanis Morissette record. He was Alanis Morissette's co-writer on that. And I think after that he did like Nine Lives with Aerosmith or something, or he did like some late 90s Aerosmith record. So a very big pop guy, and Every Day was a big selling record, but the fans weren't as into it. And around that time, they hated that record, way too poppy. And around that time, there were also, you know, there was word leaking out about this Lost album that Dave Matthews Band had worked on in 99 and 2000 with Steve Lillywhite, which I guess one of the working titles of that record was called, it's like The Summer Thus Far or something.
Summer So Far.
The Summer So Far. Although I guess, like Dave Matthews said later, that wasn't really the title. I think he wanted to call it Busted Stuff, which is what...
Yeah, they eventually called another record. Yeah.
Exactly. They ended up re-recording a lot of those songs on the Lillywhite sessions for that 2002 record, Busted Stuff. But anyway, this album ends up leaking on Napster in like 2001, and it becomes like this big hit among fans. And the idea was that basically Dave Matthews... In the band, they were like working out of this house, I think outside of Charlottesville, and Dave Matthews was like drinking a lot at this time, and he was writing what he called like sad bastard songs. And so it's sort of like a more maybe downbeat record than some of the other Dave Matthews records. And I read this thing, this is like a Rolling Stone story from 2001 talking about this record. And I guess like one of like the label heads talked to Carter Beauford and was like, are you into this record? And Beauford was like, no, I'm not feeling it. So then the label was like, okay, well, fuck it. Like, we're going to hook Dave up with Glenn Ballard, and he's going to write pop songs. And then they put out Every Day after that. And then Every Day comes out, and Carter Beauford's like, I don't like this record either. So it's like, Carter Beauford, what the fuck? You can't make this guy
Carter,
happy.
Yeah, Carter, we all relied on you. Now you're fucking with us.
But anyway, I mean, that's some of the background of this record. I mean, it was basically, I mean, like, I'm right, right? Like, these were songs that they worked on in 99-2000, kind of sadder songs, and they were shelved. And I mean, it seems like it's not clear if the label told them not to put it out or if the band themselves decided that maybe these songs weren't good enough to come out.
Well, I don't know. I mean, records don't work out all the time. You know, somebody who makes records, I mean, I don't know. There's not a lot said about it besides, you know, they just weren't feeling it, didn't work out. Sometimes you make a record, you work your ass off on it. I mean, it's just like any other creative output. I'm sure you as a writer know this. Like, one day you'll be working on a manuscript, you're like, I'm a genius. I'm going to be known as the great writer of my time. And then the next day you're just like, wow, I want to be in a hole and I should have never done anything else besides, like, go to business school or something like that, you know?
Right.
So, you know, I think this is, I'm just projecting my own shit right now. I'm not saying this about you in particular. But I think, you know, records don't work it all the time. So this one got shelved and expanded and it moved on and they just sat on it. And I don't know the exact reasons why exactly.
I mean, like,
I just had to can it.
I mean, did you, like, how did you come across this record? Like, were you one of those people that, like, downloaded it in 01? Or were you too young for that?
No, I was kind of right on time. When I got into Dave Matthews, I mean, 2001, I was in seventh grade. I was in middle school. And that's kind of when I started to get into Dave Matthews Band. So any of you big-time Dave Matthews old school fans out there, don't shit on me. I was in seventh grade. That's when I got into Dave Matthews. I'm sorry. It was 2001, past the prime year. I know. But, you know, I remember sitting in, like, homeroom, and I enjoyed Every Day. That was like kind of the first CD I got because it had the music video with the guy in it who was hugging everybody, and I thought that was cool. So I remember buying Every Day when I was younger at Sam Goody.
Oh, wow.
In Cherryvale Mall. I think I got it with like a gift card that I had gotten for Christmas or something. I don't remember. And I remember my friend brought in. I didn't know what a burned CD was. that was like, this is the first instance of a burned CD in it. And my friend's like, hey, I burned you a Dave Matthews CD. Cause his older brother was like a Dave Matthews fan who kind of got us into DMB. We were funky suburban white kids, you know, this is how it goes. And, I remember being like, is the CD going to be like hot when I get it? Like temperature wise, like, is it going to hurt to hold or something? I don't know. And I remember he gave me a burned CD of Lou. I said, she's like, this wasn't supposed to come out. And it wasn't until much later in my teenage years, I sort of kind of put these, because that was the first time where, you know, the internet and pop music and music record buying business merged, you know, so it was a chaotic time, obviously. So for a band like as big as Dave Matthews, band to be like, wow, our records could be compromised. You know, they were pissed off and confused. You know, this is like when Metallica was big. And, you know, I wasn't old enough to know Radiohead, but, you know, like Kid A had leaked and stuff. And I think this was just a really wild west days of the internet and music coming together, and it just fucking baffled everybody. So this to be circulated amongst fans was very special for the fans, but I imagine, you know, Dave Matthews Band was none too pleased about, you know, essentially their demos or rough recordings being leaked.
And, like, I mean, obviously it has some specialness because it wasn't put out legitimately, and it has that sort of illicit appeal to it that is always really cool if you get into, like, lost albums or bootleg albums. But what about the music itself? Like, how do you feel like these songs hold up, you know, just as an album?
I think the versions, because they went on later to put some versions out on Busted Stuff that are great, but these versions of the songs, especially like Bartender, I think it's just them at their absolute peak as a recording band, you know, and they're still great, obviously, but the sort of energy they have is really raw, which is not what I describe a typical Dave Matthews Band record to sound like, is raw. I mean, I think of Dave Matthews Band records, I think, polished and like perfectionism and clean and has pop appeal, whereas these recordings are kind of on the darker side for them. You know, the production's muddy and murky. His voice is like he's making a lot of mistakes. You know, when he's doing his screams, they're kind of just like, you know, kind of off in a very, I don't know, it's Dave Matthews, like, but in like some sort of like anarchist version of it or fucked up version of it, where it's like there's finally a hint at this band being like insane people or not so well put together or not the clean rock stars that we had been presented before. This I think, this is kind of the first time, I think, to my knowledge, that, you know, this, any sort of inter-band drama was sort of coming out in the press. I just think the whole sort of environment around it and the sessions themselves and the music itself is just kind of the first time they sort of veered from the path of being such a clean-cut rock band. And the music itself is amazing, and it shows, like, all this sort of turmoil they're having. I think Dave Matthews' person was going through a lot because I think he was, in interviews, you could definitely see it, he's not really happy about how his band is seen as hokey or, you know, a party band, which they are, and that's how they, you know, put roofs over their head, as being a party band for live people. But I think you want to be taken much more seriously, so these songs are much darker. And obviously you mentioned the drinking. I think a lot of that comes through. And we got a song called Bartender, for Christ's sakes. But, you know, you ask any sort of Dave Matthews fan, or at least me personally, I think Bartender's the best thing they've ever put to tape. It's like a long, droning, 10-minute sort of psychedelic Dave Matthews song, and I think it just has incredible peaks and valleys. So Lily White Sessions, the energy and raw emotion on there holds up for me, and I think it's my absolute favorite thing they've done.
See, like, the way you're describing it again, like, I'm loving the record you're describing, because I'm just imagining, like, oh, this is like Dave Matthews Band meets, like, Tonight's the Night, you know, like, this is his Crazy Horse record, like, they're drinking fucking tequila in the studio and, like, just, you know, getting dark and raw and all that stuff. And I can kind of hear that when I listen to the record. Like, I know what you mean about Bartender. There's another song called Grace Is Gone, which is, like, another one where he's like, you know, pour me a drink and, you know, kind of like a Drown Your Sorrows type tune. And, like, I can get into that. I mean, like, a lot of it still just kind of sounds like late period Sting to me. And I like, no disrespect to Sting, because I have some Sting records in my collection, but, you know, very adult contemporary sounding to me, with, I guess, but, like, not as well recorded as maybe some of the other records. So I know you mean, like, that vibe that you're talking about, I think it is on that record. And I think it's fascinating to me that they decided not to pursue that direction. And I'm just curious, like, because you read conflicting things about this record where, I mean, you can hear that there's, like, hits on here potentially, like Busted Stuff, the first song, is, like, a pretty catchy song. I'm trying to think of, like, other catchy, like Digging a Ditch is, like, a pretty catchy number.
Digging a Ditch, fucking, and you're talking about, you mentioned Tonight's the Night, sort of Dave Matthews, and that's a really good way to put it. I think that's how I view this record. When you put the lens, like, Tonight's the Night, where it's, you know, all my friends are fucked up, I'm fucked up, let's do this, like, live and not committed to some, you know, analyze every detail of the recorded thing, let's have the mistakes in there, which is, when you talk about Neil, that's my favorite part about Neil, it's just the fucked up spaces in between the notes you're supposed to hit. And I think that's where Dave Matthews and it kind of comes close to that idea here. And a song like Dig the Ditch is just like just so in the pocket with Carter and just, you know, get heavy on digging your ditch. You know, it's just like that's kind of a Neil song. That's Dave doing Neil, if you ask me, is digging a ditch. It's kind of a chunky low-end riff and like they're just in the pocket and it's fucked up. And that's what I love about this record. It's just how damaged it sounds for Dave Matthews.
Right, right. Any other tracks like jump out to you? Like, I mean, JTR's all right. I can get behind JTR.
JTR is like, see, that's one they never did officially on a record, and that's like a fan favorite. And I love JTR. There's kind of like this sort of high life, you know, West African guitar rhythm to it. And I think that's just like a fucking groove. And, you know, it's just so cyclical and hypnotic to me, you know. And I love that song, JTR. I think that's one probably one of my favorite songs he's ever done.
I mean, it's interesting to me that, and again, I don't know what the thinking was if like, I mean, if you read between the lines about some of the background on the record, it sounds like Dave Matthews was going through some personal things, but he was also feeling down because there was an ex... I think he got the feeling that people thought he was fucking up on this record, that he wasn't, like, writing hits and that he wasn't sort of maintaining the level of commerciality that they had on the first three records. And that kind of fed into his depression. Like, in a way, it maybe made it worse for him because he was sad that... that he wasn't living up to people's expectations, and that kind of made him drink more, that made him write these sad songs. I'm just curious, like, why he felt that he had to even maintain that. Because, I mean, they were this huge touring band. They already had a lot of success. I mean, it seemed like they were sort of on that hamster wheel of feeling like they also had to be like a radio band for some reason. And they obviously did that really successfully on that Everyday record. I mean, because I think there were like a bunch of hits that came off that album, but I'm wondering why he didn't feel like he could just sort of make any kind of record he wanted and know that, well, we're still going to be able to play like stadiums, you know, like people like our records, but we're mainly about the live show. So no matter what we do in the studio, it's okay. So what, maybe we should just put out this really dark record that our hardcore fans will dig.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's funny because I think a lot of Dave Matthews fans hate what eventually came out as Everyday or whatever. A lot of, like, Dave Matthews fans are, like, pretty much in agreement that that's, like, the worst thing. This is where people, like, like, real hardcore, old school, 90s Dave Matthews fans think I'm an asshole. It's like, I love Everyday. I think that is an amazing record. And I think, you know, the darkness of the Lily White Sessions compared to, like, the lightheartedness of Everyday, you know, all you need is love every day, you know, there's like that. That's why people don't like it, because they want a dark Dave. People like this Dave that's, like, super damaged. As much as people love the, like, you know, the big party ants marching Dave, where, you know, he's doing the dances and everybody's freaking out, I think, you know, real Dave Matthews fans really like this sort of side that he came out with on Lily White Sessions and that whole time, because they never saw it before. And I don't think he liked people seeing that in him. You know, I think he wanted to actually just keep it kind of, let me have my personal life, let me have my shit. I don't like this idea of my fans knowing my personal life at all. You know, as much as he's put himself out there in previous songs, you know, a lot of his songs are very personal, but I think he's not very happy or fond of looking back on this sort of time of the Lily White Sessions where he was in a kind of a deep pit, as most people can be. I don't think that's something he wanted to share with the world at all. So he wanted to move on.
I mean, do you know, like, has he changed his mind at all on that over the years? Like, has he talked about this since then and said, oh, yeah, that was pretty good, or I'm glad that came out?
No, I mean, I think they're pretty much hush-hush about it. But at the time, you know, there's interviews, you know, obviously when it leaked, he was at the peak of his stardom, you know, in the early 2000s. And he was getting interviewed by everybody left and right. And I think they all brought it up, or he either dodged it. But when he wanted to talk about it, he's just like, you know, they seem... You know, I don't want to say pissed off, but they were just like frustrated. Because, you know, it's just bored recordings. It's rough recordings that weren't finished that got put out there. So anything like that, you know, I'm on a much smaller scale, obviously, but if, like, my unfinished record came out, I'd be like, well, what the fuck, man? Like,
yeah.
So obviously they were none too thrilled, and I still think to this day they're kind of none too thrilled, because there's Dave Matthews has these huge archives they're well known about, you know, just songs like this vault of recordings that is just sitting there, and a lot of Dave Matthews fans are just like, release that whole era of music. This is like the peak of your creativity. We want to hear this shit as your real fans. But they're just kind of holding on to it. So everybody's kind of waiting for a big box set or something like that from that era. But it's well known, you know, like Steve Lewis and the We've recorded fucking 120 songs nobody's heard about, you know, that are just sitting there.
Yeah.
So I think they're not too fond of that era.
Now, I have to say, like, I'm still not sold on the Dave Matthews version of the Lily White Sessions, but I actually really like your record. Like, I like your versions of these songs more than Dave Matthews, and it's because you did them in your style more than Dave. And it was really interesting going back, and because I heard your record, I probably listened to your record more than the Lily White Sessions, even though I've had those files on my computer for a while. I'm just wondering, like, what was your approach to covering this record? Like, what were you hoping to do, and like, how did you go about sort of interpreting these songs?
Well, the whole thing started. One of the guys who works at Secretly Canadian label that puts out my records, we always kind of gone back and forth, you know, in like at the Christmas parties for the label and stuff. Just kind of like, man, I should do a Dave Matthews, because he's an old school Dave Matthews fan too. And we're kind of in, you know, the very vocal minority of Dave fans in that whole crew. It's just like, Dave rules, you guys suck, fuck you, you don't get it, you know, all that love. So eventually it was kind of like we talked about the Lily White Sessions a lot. I mean, to back it up, and I'll try to keep this whole thing short, it's just over the last 5 years I've gotten way back into Dave Matthews. When I was a much younger kid, I was a big Dave Matthews fan, but I fell out of it for, you know, whatever reason. I got into like Pavement, Sonic Youth records, and just kind of moved on into being an indie rock fan and stuff like that. And sort of just kind of put it on the wayside and forgot about it. None of this spite. But, you know, the last 5 years, I started putting on Dave stuff, you know, because my brain's just gone insane the last 5 years. I've just tried to revisit a lot of things, and I've tried to listen to music in a different way than I did when I was younger without so much walls around me or trying to be cool for whatever 21-year-old I was around at the time or whatever when I was that age. So I started putting on Dave Matthews, and the song Grace Is Gone, my friend Brian Pinheiro, shout out to Brian Pinheiro, one of my best friends, we were at his house in New York City about 5 years ago, and from the AOL sessions, this is Dave Matthews playing Grace Is Gone, solo on guitar. And he put that on, I'm like, is this Dave? And he's like, yeah, man, I've been listening to this nonstop. He's like, and he's like a techno guy, you know, like Brian Pinheiro's like a hardcore, like, techno dude, like that's all he listens to. He's like, this song kills me every time I put it on. So since then, I've just been listening to Dave so much. And eventually going on to my friend who works at the label, we talk about Dave all the time, trade live shows. And eventually he was like, hey, you should cover the Lily White Sessions as a special project. Because my intention was for right now to do a covers record no matter what, but I couldn't think of the right covers to do. And I got to thinking that, you know, doing something intrinsically cool, like let's say I did like a Zeppelin record or a Floyd record or, you know, whatever band that is universally agreed that they're a cool band. You know, I want to do something that was just more ridiculous and absurd kind of, but not a joke. And I'm a big Dave Matthews fan, so we're like, let's go to the Lily White Sessions. And so the project came alive. My friend Andrew and Ryan both play on the record. They're really excited about it too because they were Dave Matthews fans growing up. And so basically, the only approach I had was like, let's do like, you know, what if Lucifer was doing a Dave Matthews record? Because that's the music we enjoy a lot. Is I'm a big Lucifer and Jim O'Rourke fan, I think, and that's always kind of a starting point to how I like to write songs. I just love their sort of arrangements and stuff like that, and just Chicago indie rock in general.
Yeah.
So those sorts of influences I have writing my own music, put Dave Matthews to that filter, and that's kind of what came out. And obviously, we wanted to keep them lighthearted and fun. And the big thing was that we didn't want to make it some sort of joke, like we're making fun of Dave Matthews or anything like that. And that's where, like, you know, the conversation of why didn't you do Crash or Number 41, Ants Marching, any of their big songs, or just the main populace would know. And it's just, I don't know, I kind of want to do what makes it more absurd, obviously, and more fun. is doing songs that only hardcore Dave Matthews fans would know.
Yeah.
So not we have there's no selling single on here. You know, there's no big single like, you know, What Would You Say or anything like that. We're just doing songs that only the most hardcore Dave Matthews fans would know. And again, it's absurd, but it's really fun, and it was a joy to do.
No, I'm so glad you did it because, again, as someone who knows about Dave Matthews Band, and I feel like I want to appreciate him, and I haven't gotten there yet. I feel like, well, this could be a good way to sort of midwife me into an appreciation of Dave Matthews. So I appreciate you doing that. I have to ask, have you had any interaction with the Dave Matthews camp over this?
The Dave Matthews camp is very aware of it. Dave Matthews has the music, and beyond that, I don't know. Because we had to get permission to do all these songs because they're unreleased, so the powers that be are very aware of it. And, you know, they kind of reached out to me, like, what's up with this project we're hearing about? And so, yeah, I've somehow bridged Dead Oceans Records and the Dave Matthews camp. And I think, yeah, there's a nice, healthy dialogue going, and the powers that be know what's going on.
And are they cool with it?
The man himself has the music, and I don't want to get my hopes up, but I'm hoping to become his best friend of all time. We'll become inseparable.
Like, maybe he'll call you up and be like, Riley, I like your record, or something like that.
Yeah,
that's my Dave Matthews impression.
That would be really beautiful.
Well, dude, again, I really appreciate the education. You know, we didn't agree on this record, but again, I think you might get me there eventually. I think you make a great case for Dave Matthews and the Lily White Sessions, and your record is really great. I think if you're not a Dave Matthews fan, because I'm not, I think you'll still like Riley's record a lot. It's really cool. So, Riley, thanks again. It's always fun doing these with you, and I'm excited to do another one very soon.
Yeah, absolutely. And for anybody out there who's looking for a good live show of Dave, the Red Rocks box set is great, but also check out Live from Chicago, the United Center, in December of 98. That show, I think, will transform you. And, Steven, I really appreciate your time, and I love being on your podcast.
All right, Riley. Hey, man, take it easy. We'll do it again soon, brother.
Absolutely. Dave, bless you.
All right, so that was me and Riley getting into it. Always fun doing Contrarians Canon. Derek, I don't know. I'm still not into to Dave.
I have a contrarian point to make here because I think it's interesting to me that you were highly critical of Dave's voice.
I did a very flattering impression. I thought.
Yeah. I thought you sort of had him as a leprechaun to me in the impression. So, like, Dave Matthews' voice, pitchy and weird and annoying in your eyes, but, like, some acoustic Neil Young, you're here for that.
Well, yeah. I mean, to me, Dave Matthews, it just has always struck me as being very affected, you know?
Yeah.
Like, and
but,
Neil
like,
Young,
so is Bob Dylan.
Yeah, I don't know. No, okay, to say that you have to, like, all annoying voices... I don't think it's like a
all
good
right.
case,
no,
you know,
no.
Everything strikes you as different. I mean, I would say, you know, Bob Dylan has like a range of expression within his nasally whine that is very wide and large, and he can sing a lot of different kinds of songs. And Neil Young to me, I don't look at that as being affected. I feel like that's probably just how he sings. It just doesn't seem as like,
I mean, don't you think he sort of has, he has
theatrical.
A different like acoustic voice versus the like the crazy horse voice. You know what I mean?
I don't know. I feel like this argument will only make me hate Neil Young. It will not help me like Dave Matthews. Yeah. So I don't want to go down that road too far.
I'm not here to say Dave is better than Neil Young or Bob
Dylan. I think that's the poll quote from this.
but I do think he is a little underrated as a front man. And I do think that is one of the things, and I thought Riley was smart to point that out, that separates Dave Matthews Band from some of those bands that they're coming
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's no question. And just his ability to write pop songs is far beyond anyone in the jam band scene of that era, for sure. And again, you know, I love to come around on bands that I didn't like for a very long time. And I've done it before, and, you know, maybe I'll do it with Dave. I'm going to keep trying. But definitely check out that Riley Walker record, even if you're not a fan of Dave. His version of the Lily White Sessions is really cool. So that is all for this week's episode of Celebration Rock. I want to thank Derek, the man with the plan, the man who makes it happen, the man who defends Dave Matthews and dismisses Neil Young. Thank you, Derek. Thank you to Josh Copperman for writing our theme song. And thank you to all of you for listening to the show and for supporting us and for leaving feedback and for telling your friends. We wouldn't exist without you, so thank you so much for being there for us. That's it for this week. We will see you with more Celebration Rock next week. Take it easy.
On the Westwood One Podcast Network.
The countdown is on for the 2024 NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, live from Detroit, and you can attend in person for free.
Welcome to the NFL Draft.
See the next NFL stars and experience the ultimate NFL fan festival, featuring live concerts, interactive games, player autographs, and more. The NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, April 25th through 27th. Visit NFL.com/draft access to register for free entry today.